You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast. In studio with me today is a longtime contributor to the magazine, an acclaimed biographer, a physicist, and a coffee aficionado, Graham Farmelow. Hello, Graham.
Hi, Karen.
The reason I've dragged Graham in here today from Richmond, from Cambridge, from wherever he is going in the middle of promoting an acclaimed new book is indeed the new book, which is our book of the week, Churchill's Bomb, A Hidden History of Science, War, and Politics. And on the cover, we have a very grumpy looking old man. He looks quite drawn, actually. Graham, I know that you're not afraid of tackling big and difficult subjects, as your previous book showed us, but taking on Churchill, that's not an easy task.
That's right. I, to be honest, I didn't know what I let myself in for when I took on that subject. But I was intrigued. I was just intrigued about how this cohort of scientists at the very frontiers of fundamental science was suddenly dragged from doing curiosity-driven science in the open within a matter of months, going underground, working in top secret with perhaps the most acclaimed prime minister of the 20th century. What a wrench for them, and also what a responsibility for him, as posterity has shown, because he was the first prime minister who really had to deal with the availability of nuclear weapons.
And of all the things that have been said about Churchill, all the books that have been written about him, all the footage, all our own mental images of the bulldog with the cigar, his role in the development of the bomb, his thoughts on nuclear science, on nuclear power, are among the less well-known, I suppose, strands to the Churchill image.
That's absolutely right. For example, Roy Jenkins' biography, which I think is terrific, really hardly mentions the atomic bomb and Churchill. I mean, I look at it now and I think, my goodness, how could he have missed out so much of this? But it's still a beautifully written biography. I wanted to make Churchill front and center of the book. I also wanted to feature the scientist, but I knew that the focus was going to be on Churchill because he's such a written about character. What I also felt was an obligation to provide a fresh view of this politician. And what I feared was writing where people saying, "Oh, here we go again. I know this. I know this. I know this." And yet, I also wanted to be true to his character. Because, you know, excellent biographers, excellent writers have written about Churchill, and I don't want to diss what they've done at all, because there's some great work there. But as I said, I wanted to try to provide something that was fresh. And my take was Churchill and nuclear science. I mean, Churchill and science have been written about before, but never in detail Churchill and the challenge of developing nuclear weapons.
And you talk a lot about something known quite charmingly, or perhaps from the people who said it at the time dismissively, as Churchill's toy shop. The scientists he brought in, Frederick Lindemann, chief among them. This is not a story perhaps that we know about, not only because there are other things to say about Churchill that rather hog the limelight, but that, am I right that the story of the development of nuclear weapons has largely been told by the victors, in this case the Americans? And so many of those stories of the development of the bomb were written from a US perspective and didn't focus on the British role.
Largely, that's true. There's a classic book by Richard Rhodes called The Making of the Atomic
Bomb.
Which
you mentioned.
Right, which is a very fine, comprehensive account, largely, not exclusive, but largely from the American point of view. There is a first-rate account of the British bomb by the historian of science Margaret Gowing, assisted by Lorna Arnold. But I wasn't seeking to reproduce that in any way. I was trying to write an account of Churchill's involvement with his physicists and the development of the bomb. So I was seeking to do something quite unusual, a kind of multiple biography with a broad historical theme. You see, it's not just a straightforward account of the British bomb by any means.
And it's a story of a missed opportunity, I suppose. The fact that Britain could have been working much more closely with America, but the Manhattan Project went ahead in the end largely without British involvement because it seems to me of personalities, be it Lindemann, be it Churchill. Churchill, as you describe here, spends a lot of time sucking up to Roosevelt. But in one fatal moment in October 1941, didn't answer a cable from Roosevelt about the two nations working together.
Yeah. Well, I believe quite strongly that that was a missed opportunity. As ever, whenever you're working in the field of virtual history, there's always people, very smart people, who can argue something different. And and I acknowledge you can say that Churchill was extremely hard-pressed. His leading advisers were urging for Britain to hold on. That is true. But in my view, there is an extremely strong case for saying that Churchill was particularly tardy in this. Remember, this was a very, in a sense, he was very unlucky because this was October 41.
He was a bit busy.
He was very, very busy, that's true. But also, what happened 2 months later, of course, was Pearl Harbor. And then the Americans ran off with this project with an awe-inspiring energy and commitment, right? And Churchill and Britain was in were really more or less left behind. But you just look at the pattern of Churchill's involvement. Really, he didn't become properly engaged until about March 1943, which is late. And perhaps the thing that perhaps more than anything surprises me about Churchill's involvement, well, there are two things actually that are connected. One is the extremely impressive set of articles written by Churchill in the 20s and 30s where he saw the nuclear age coming. This, to me, is a wonderful example of a politician staying ahead of the game, looking ahead. All right, he's closely advised by Lindemann, that's true, but nonetheless, he's someone of enormous capacity, of great breadth of interest, who's prepared to go out there and say these things to the public.
And these were things he was thinking about early on, inspired by H.G. Wells, musing on what might come. And this, a lot of this happened during his period as a journalist.
That's
when
right, in the
power.
30s and also in the 20s. This, to me, is extremely impressive. How many politicians would do that today, I ask you? Right. I mean, but then the thing that surprises me on top of that is that someone so well prepared, so clued up, could be so slow, right, in recognizing the potential of this weapon, which was admittedly speculative. There's no doubt about that.
But the British were leading the field at this point.
They were. In 1940, it was.
And New Zealanders, of course.
Of course. Well, Ernest Rutherford. There's no finer experimentalist in the last 150 years. Going back to those scientists, they gave Churchill a remarkable lead,
and he squandered it.
I think he could have made much more of it. It was pitiful, really, the way Britain ended up by paying catch-up this.
As you say, it seems astonishing because he was like a kid in a toy shop with gadgets, you know, order 1,000 of them, order a million of them. So the idea that this could have been something that could have helped win the war or at least, you know, forestall any German development of the weapon. It's not as though he had no interest in weapons. He was interested in tanks and so on very early on when other people weren't.
Yep.
And of course, his career is almost topped and tailed by that. It seems that your book points out he begins, you know, early on thinking about the potential of nuclear weapons. And by the end, he's talking about the need to restrict nations' ability to use them and goes out on a kind of valedictory note, not quite CND, but
I have to say again, I didn't know about this when I started to write the book. This is some years ago, but he was obsessed by nuclear weapons at the end, the hydrogen bomb in particular, because this was the classic example of something he talked about, you know, in the 1920s, of where science had given enormous, or virtually a power that you could barely dream of, to politicians, and he was wondering then whether politicians would be able to handle it. So when he saw the enormous power of the hydrogen bomb, he genuinely worried whether human beings, in particular politicians, would be able to handle it. And this was his idée fixe at the end. He was really interested in very little else at the end of his second term as Prime Minister.
And it's a reminder of just how long he was front and centre in political life and in cultural life in the country.
Indeed.
It's It's quite a cast of characters in this book. One thing that struck me when I was reading it, everyone's in here, including Charles Darwin, admittedly, yes. The grandson of the Charles Darwin
well,
we've
Charles
heard
Darwin
of.
Himself's in there, because Churchill read this when he was a subaltern in India. I mean, that's another thing I just want to point out. You know, this is a guy, Churchill, forgive my disrespectful reference to him, but not regarded as not bright enough to go to college by his father, so he basically does a DIY university course reading dozens of volumes, including Darwin, including Introductions to Physics. You know, this is a wonderfully commendable thing, it seems.
Didn't
to
like
me.
Maths, he said,
no.
But struggled with it, and
he gave it a go.
The appetite of the autodidact, in
yeah,
a way.
I mean, I seriously find that extremely impressive.
But do you think then that sense, that desire to think about the future, whether it's through reading H.G. Wells, or the sense of wanting to educate himself, perhaps left him a little in awe of scientists, which is probably as it should be in a politician rather than... But he was easy prey for Frederick Lindemann, Viscount Charwell.
That's an interesting perspective. I don't think prey is the right word because...
Sure.
But I know what you're getting at. Lindemann, a.k.a. Charwell, virtually worshipped Churchill. He knew that Churchill wasn't, an Einsteinian intellect, but he hugely admired his his catholicity of interests, his persuasiveness as a politician, his ability to weigh up evidence and what have you. And I think there's very little doubt that Lindemann was extremely ambitious himself. He wanted to be right at the side of the leader of the country, and he achieved that.
And he had some good parlour tricks as well. You recount point at which he's dining with the Churchills and a pocket watch is put on the table, 5 minutes to summarise quantum theory
mechanic.
In words of one syllable.
Yeah, well, one of
I
the
think
things...
he must have cheated.
I doubt whether
nuclear,
he did.
Nuclear, that's
well,
more than one,
that, actually, this argues for your prey business because... you see, it's easy when you have no competition to be very impressive,
right?
As a frontline scientist. And Lindemann was a very good scientist. Let's be clear about that. He was a very smart guy. He had references from Rutherford, Millikan in the United States, and others. There's no doubt that he got his professorship at Oxford fair and square. But he pretty quickly went to seed as a researcher.
Did he have a second-rate mind? Is that the kinds of things
that's unfair.
Some scientists
I
like
do think
to
that's
say.
Unfair. He remember, he was a fellow of the Royal Society. You know, he was a good scientist, but he very quickly got seduced into being a lackey of the lords and ladies. Remember, they say, why is he like an ocean steamer? He went from pier to pier. It was a wonderful, not my line, but a wonderful
line. It's a fantastic line.
Yeah, it's a fantastic line.
And, of course, ends up a Viscount.
He does, indeed. That's right. I think there's an equivalent wordplay on that, but... But he was someone who was extremely impressive in company. But what I have exposed here, I think for the first time in a popular book, is that if you look at what Lindemann was saying and doing and thinking about quantum physics, he really didn't grasp the theory at all well. And
he shut out other people.
Yes, he did.
Were perhaps better informed. His ex-boxing partner.
Oh, that's for sure. I mean, Henry Tizard was a really first-rate practitioner in the field of making science available to the military in a way that was actually useful to them. And there's no doubt about it that... That Lindemann was appalling to Tizard, as was Churchill. This is one of the things that does Churchill no credit. I think the important thing here is that, in my opinion, like in any biographical work, there's good and bad in everyone. I know it sounds a cliche, but I didn't want to write this work on my knees, so to speak, about Churchill. But I wanted to do him credit in where he, in my opinion, deserved it, and be critical of the parts where he perhaps fell slightly short. Overall, I mean, I emerged from writing the book extremely impressed by him.
Even though at one point the statement is made. By someone. Perhaps it was you.
Perhaps it was me.
Churchill treated the British nuclear project as something close to a private fiefdom.
Yes, he did. That is correct. And the same is true of Franklin Roosevelt. Another, in my judgment, great leader of his country. They basically took the nuclear projects, shut out virtually everyone from their inner circle, a handful of people on both sides, and they were talking about it essentially privately. This is where we get the Quebec Agreement of 1943, where those two leaders basically set out what a personal agreement, as I put it.
You point out that Attlee had no idea what was going on when these things were.
Did not know what was going on. The same for those close to Roosevelt. So when Roosevelt dies, not unexpectedly, his successor knew nothing about, essentially nothing about the development of the bomb.
You say toward the end of the book that, you know, science is generally done collegially. Obviously, there are great men of science, great women as well,
yes.
Although there are not many in this book, reflective of the time. But that perhaps it's the difference between the way science is done and the way politics is done, consensus. But what struck me, however, was that Churchill's not the only person in this cast who is autocratic, pushing through his own vision and directing things. Many of the great scientists you mention here, obviously Rutherford had his boys, not his colleagues. Yep. Obviously, they were younger, they were junior. He trained them up and sent them out like James Chadwick.
Yeah, that's right.
Aside from maybe Niels Bohr, who didn't seem like he was striding around telling people what to do, but unfortunately he mumbled a lot. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people in this book, a lot of the researchers, were also those sorts of people, were they not? They were running their fiefdoms within the ambit of their power. So perhaps it's not the difference between science and politics, but more a difference between personalities and opportunities to be
running the show. Well, in Churchill's case, I think he has to be excused a bit of megalomania at the beginning.
There was
of the war.
A war on.
He took over a very difficult. I mean, it sounds a bland thing to say, but you know, Britain was really up against it, and its Commonwealth, of course, was on side. But it needed that firm leadership. I think it would be perverse to deny that. But Lindemann, when he was running a laboratory, ran it like a Prussian dictator, apparently. Rutherford was more benign in his dictatorial ways, there are styles of leadership that are common, I suppose.
Christopher Hinton.
The book. That's definitely true. They're a very, very tough leader. That is very true. Yes, I mean, you know, there are some leaders who are much more quiet. For example, Cockcroft. You mentioned Christopher Hinton. He was the person who did so much for nuclear power in Britain, particularly during Churchill's second term. Mm-hmm. But let's look at Sir John Cockcroft. And they didn't get along terribly well as people, but Cockcroft was a very, very quiet, unassuming person. Remember that there's a line in my book that his children used to say they wouldn't let Daddy leave
the table until he'd spoken two complete
sentences. That's
what
right.
What a marvellous detail.
I know.
Where did you find that?
From his children, who all agreed that was the case. But no one could accuse Sir John Cockcroft as being a bully or a megalomaniac. He just wasn't. There are different styles for these things. But I think with the greatest respect to Sir John Cockcroft, he wouldn't be the kind of person perhaps you want in charge of a country, who had a prime minister that was a proven failure. I mean, but as you say, there are different leadership styles in the book. That's definitely true.
So much of the events appear to hang not only on but on personalities.
Yes.
Is that inherently the sort of thing that as a biographer you are going to find when you are considering history? If Lindemann had been a bit more collegiate or hadn't been such an awful social climber, if Churchill hadn't been the sort of person who maybe hoped things could be sorted out with felicitous phrases, as he was hoping at the end that perhaps
yes,
this could be brought about if
loved,
you could just give the right speech.
He loved his own eloquence, as do we, many of us still, but he loved it in particular.
And that if, say, the British academic community or perhaps the British political community community hadn't been so worried about enemy aliens. Obviously, you point out that Klaus Fuchs, one of the scientists addressed here, was spying, albeit for the Soviets. But prior to that, Rudy Piles and others were seen as suspicious, even though they were refugees from Germany.
That's true.
And they weren't trusted, and they were shut out of opportunities. And there seems to be the implication in the book as well that America was much more welcoming to quote-unquote enemy aliens. Fermi and others.
They were. That's not to say that they didn't have their suspicions of some of those people, but you're right. I think it's quite clear there was a missed opportunity in Britain there. I think Mickey Weisskopf actually said this, that they would many of them would have loved to have come to Britain, but there was a sense of the British government being like a traffic cop on an island, basically waving them through to the United States. Where you know they provided what you might call the backbone of the Manhattan Project, albeit directed scientifically by Robert Oppenheimer. But can I just pick up that point you made, which I think is a good one, that historians like, and for very good reason, to look at the large scale forces of history, and that's fair enough to do that. But in this particular case, I wanted to bring out just how much could have gone differently. For example, I know it's a moot point, but imagine Churchill had treated that telegram from Roosevelt in October 1941, right, in the same spirit that he normally responded to
it seems astonishing.
And written back and said, fine, Franklin, we'll send our emissary over, we want to work with you, right? Just supposing he had done that. Now, I'm not suggesting, right, and some people have accused me of, which I'm not suggesting, that it could have been 50-50, Britain has half.
Still,
there's no way Britain could have afforded that. But my goodness, could they have struck, in my judgment, a much better bargain? They were ahead at that time. They had some of the best nuclear physicists in the world at that time. Surely that they would have struck a much better deal had that been done.
But you suggest that maybe it was simply that Churchill wasn't really sure what MOD was.
Perhaps
he was so busy that he didn't look at it very carefully and thought,
course,
oh, this isn't terribly important.
He was incredibly busy, and he relied very, very strongly, in a sense, understandably, on Lindemann to look after this thing. Because remember, it was a very speculative weapon, and bearing that in mind, it wasn't something that was in his face, so to speak. Right? But he relied very, very heavily on Lindemann, whose advice was not always that good. Sometimes it was good, but it was, you know, this is the problem, you see. One of my favourite lines in science is the Royal Society's motto, which loosely translated into modern English is, take nobody's word for it. Churchill took Lindemann's word for it far too often in scientific matters, in my view. And that's something that that politicians have to be aware of. There is no scientific authority, no matter how august, that in whom a politician should invest all their trust. That was a central charge I would make against Churchill.
And it does seem that perhaps now as well as then, the sort of people who are most interested in having the ear of powerful politicians or working their way through those corridors may not be the people driven by the desire to do the best possible research. They may be themselves quite ambitious. You point out that Lindemann ran for office himself and finished last in his constituency.
Yep.
So the voters didn't like him any more than fellow scientists did. And it also seemed, you know, that wonderful image of Rudy Piles toward the end of the book being campaigning against the nuclear threat. Standing out in public, talking to people
in a
Saturday.
Precinct, that's right.
And, you know, he was obviously someone who wasn't perhaps motivated by the same things that Lindemann was. So now, when we look at issues in Westminster, government advisors who speak unpalatable truths, which Lindemann did sometimes, those who speak unpalatable truths tend to get slung out. David Nutt is a great case in point. His comments on drugs, he summarily found himself no longer an advisor to government. So will that always be a problem? Can you see any way that things could be set up differently that politicians and leaders would have to take the advice of scientists, but be sure they're not just getting awful kind of political social climbers.
Well, in the end, I have to say, as a Democrat, if politicians are elected, they have to take the decisions. That you have to say that. I don't think, I don't know of any scientists who think that they should actually take those decisions. The thing to do, what I hope this book it makes a small contribution to, is to demonstrate that you need these scientific advisors, but you should never rely on just one.
Just one,
right? And I have to say, going back, this story is not a black and white story, or it's not composed of black and white segments. In Churchill's second premiership, Lindemann really stuck it to Churchill, right? When Churchill said, "Well, we don't need these bombs, we don't need this, we don't need that, we can get all of our nuclear stuff from the United States," and Lindemann wrote a ferociously candid set of letters, actually, to Churchill, and that, to me, although I'm no huge admirer of Lindemann as a personality, speaks well of him. He had the courage to go to his boss and take him on full square.
That must have raised him in your estimation.
It did.
Because in the course of writing this book and researching this book, you must have come across plenty of proof that Lindemann was not the loveliest of characters and not the best advisor.
No, but not wholly bad.
Right.
Not wholly bad. As I said, this is the thing. When summarizing people, people often want the big story. You know, they want this appalling social climber who gave unreliable things. But, you know, it's actually more subtle than that. And I hadn't realized until I'd actually finished the research on the book that in the second term, I'm not suggesting he has some Damascene conversion, but he becomes a more courageous figure telling Churchill like it is, and also more able to work with the scientists delivering the British nuclear bomb and civil nuclear power in Britain. He's much, and was actually quite popular with Christopher Hinton, with William Penny, with Sir John Cockcroft. He was a respected figure there. So if you like, there is an improvement, if I might put it there.
He's not a cardboard villain twiddling his moustache in the stately homes of Britain.
That is too much. I think, you know, looking back, I mean, this is amateur psychology, and I wouldn't put this in the book, but my hunch is that, you know, he felt very much in awe of Rutherford, and, you know, because it was very bad luck in some sense, you know, to have someone of Rutherford's preeminent brilliance working at Cambridge, and he was told, this is Lindemann, that you have to try and catch these guys up in Cambridge, and there was no way he was going to do that, right? But so he was always trying to prove himself, I think, in that during the Second World War. But I think, even though he was old, he was sick, he was tired, his performance was much better, in my opinion, in the second premiership of Churchill.
Graham, now the story is essentially how Britain lost the chance to participate fully in the Manhattan Project. Of course, the name already gave us a hint that by that point it was very much an American project, and that its lead in development of this technology lost out because of these factors. But is in the big picture, speaking beyond Britain, is this a tragedy? Or, I mean, obviously, when England loses a chance at winning the World Cup, people in England discuss how awful it is if only the goalkeeper had been more on the ball. But in the big picture, football goes on. In the big picture here, the bomb was developed. It was not very nice for Japan. It led to, you know, the arms race, the Cold War, and then efforts to ensure that these weapons were not used again. But does it really matter that Britain didn't win and that America did in the sense of developing
it's a bomb? It's a very fair question. The first thing I would say is that people like James Chadwick, absolutely nobody's fool, William Penny and others said, all right, the Americans have frozen us out after the war, we've got to stand on our own 2 feet. It actually does us good. Right, it did cost a lot of money, additional money. It was didn't show great grace on the part of the Americans, but the Britain got the bomb, which all its politicians, its electorate wanted, pretty well all of them.
And right? Atlee spent a lot of money.
And Atlee,
on
again, very secretively, spent a lot of money under the table, so to speak, getting that. So I think your point is well made there. To me, the thing that where if I had a kind of godlike power to rerun history. The thing that is the bigger issue is Niels Bohr going to Churchill, going to Roosevelt, saying, you know, that we have a situation here where our allies, the Soviet Union, this is the end of the war, this is an unsatisfactory situation. We are pursuing this gargantuan project. They know nothing about it.
Let's
share with them. Let's establish trust, right? Now, one mustn't be naive about this. Stalin was not a high school or a Sunday school teacher given to fawning over his other allies. But I personally think, and I'm not alone in this, Oppenheimer thought it, Sir John Anderson, one of Churchill's closest advisors, thought the same. If Churchill and Roosevelt had been listened more carefully to the mumbling voice of the Great Dane, I think there's a much better chance that the horrifying arms race that followed the war during the Cold War could have been much, much less serious. Now, I know that this is a matter of virtual history, but to me, in your well-posed question, that's the thing that, on a millennial scale, could, in my opinion, could
that
have
was the great missed opportunity. Not did Britain win the race to
that's,
blow up
in my judgment, bomb. That is the thing that I picked up from this. That's right.
Such a poignant moment in two places where you have Bohr speaking sense, and because he mumbles or isn't particularly clear, or people aren't in the right place to hear him toward the start of the book, toward the end of the book, you know, perhaps the greatest sage, and that opportunity was missed.
Yes. Well, it is true that the reverence that other scientists have for Bohr is extraordinary. I still don't think I fully understand it, to be perfectly honest. Because, I mean, there's no doubt that Bohr was a very fine scientist. There's no doubt about that.
But also a moral figure, someone
yes,
who's enormously respected
to me,
for his...
To me, although without denying he's a very fine scientist, what makes him a great human being is his generosity of spirit and his broad wisdom. I reject the notion that he was a naive utopian and what have you. I think he was someone much bigger than that. But what let him down in these ghastly corporate speak was his communication skills. You know, he just could not get that message across. Although, let's be fair to everyone, Churchill and Roosevelt were not exactly all ears hanging on his every word. You know, history would have spoken better of them if they had listened more carefully, I think.
He needed to refine his impact statements, Graham. I think there are a lot of university departments who will be.
I suppose he would have got an A star rating on research and possibly had to do an extra appraisal because his communication skills were just not up to it. That's right.
This is somewhat of a different book to the book that many will associate your name with, The Strangest Man, a tale of Paul Dirac, quantum physicist. Mm. I remember asking you recently, since Dirac was the strangest man, what about Lindemann? He was eccentric, and you set me right on that. There's a quantum order of difference between the two personalities, I suppose. There you were focusing on one man who readers should have known more about but didn't. Here you're focusing on a big cast of characters and a man that we all think we know something about. Did that alter how you approached the book?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Dirac is a colossal figure in theoretical physics. Right, stands right up there with Einstein. And as you say, most people outside the subject know next to nothing about him.
They know about him now.
They know
I'd
about
say.
Him now.
After
I hope. Well, many some
after
people
the Costa
do.
Prize and the Los Angeles Times well, some, they, Prize they, for books.
Some
Graham.
People know about him now, but. I had to make him an engaging character, and I was blessed because there was this wonderful archive of material which, with his unusual character, made him an interesting person, I think. And that's what I tapped to try to get people interested in his physics. This is different. People come, I think, interested, so to speak, in Churchill, right? Perhaps wary that they're just going to hear more of the same. But my challenge here was to interweave these different characters and make it a narrative that people would enjoy and find rewarding.
And, of course, in this book, at the same time, you managed to give a little shout-out for the University of Liverpool, your alma mater, by talking about James Chadwick. When you were there as a student, was there anyone from his era who was still in your department?
No. I remember we used to go to lectures in the Chadwick Laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And I gather there's a part of Liverpool now named after Joe Rotblat, who's a very important figure.
The Pugwash.
Pugwash founder, great figure. So yes, big shout out to University of Liverpool. And of course, let's not forget, Churchill's last initiative in science was to found what we now call Churchill College, which I'm very proud to be a bifellow there. And on my website, there is a picture of Churchill speaking, almost certainly taken by Paul Dirac, because it was found in Dirac's daughter's linen cupboard, some pictures, and it's extremely likely that it was either taken by Paul Dirac or Mansi Dirac. So there we are. There's a link between the two books.
Those must be those lovely moments of serendipity after hours of trawling through archives.
You should have heard my language when Dirac's daughter said, look at these pictures. And there I saw this picture of Churchill on the site of Churchill's College, right, in the photographic album of Paul Dirac. Astonishing.
How do you feel about this doorstopper of a book now that it's done and people like me are asking you questions about it? Are you pleased with it?
Well, it was a long haul. It took me as long as Dirac did. But yes, I'm pleased with it. I just hope people enjoy it as much as they appear to have done Dirac.
And you don't have to be a physicist.
No, heaven forbid. Although I recommend it nonetheless.
Thank you very much, Graham.
My pleasure, Karen.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.